everybody, and welcome to Shelfware Single Sitting with Scott and Mark. I'm Scott, and hello, Mark.
Hello there.
Welcome, welcome. I'm really excited about this. So we've been talking about this. Yeah, we've been talking about this idea for a little while. This idea that, it was Edgar Allan Poe's idea, right? That a piece of work that can be taken in a single sitting can have a singular effect.
Grabbing you into its atmosphere and never let you go until you're finished reading in right. That single sitting. That's it.
Right. And not allowing you to stop and go back to the world where the world can interfere with the effect that's being produced.
That's it.
So, yeah. So in this series of podcasts, we're going to be talking about short fiction mostly, but it'll be wide open. We're not going to limit ourselves to any genre or even fiction. I mean, who knows what'll come up? What comes up, comes up. Mark, I'd like you to talk about sort of a philosophy we were thinking about for the podcast. You said it comes from Immanuel Kant.
Yeah, there is one quotation by Immanuel Kant that expresses my reaction to those stories to be read at a single setting, I think, best. I think I'll read it for you.
Okay.
Two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and awe, the more often and steadily we reflect upon them. The starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. That's from Immanuel Kant's Critique of Practical Reason. Mm. And I think it catches a sense of wonder that is so often thought about as really important to science fiction, but which is also important for other stories perfectly. The idea that for once in this single sitting, you're taken a little bit out of your own mind, out of your own body, and your own mind has to catch up with it and has to make head or tails of it. It irritates you in the best possible ways. It enhances your empathy, maybe, later on. But for the moment, you say, what was that? What is it? What am I reading here? What is going on? And this can happen to you in essays. It can happen to you trivially in science fiction and fantasy, but also in other genres as well, and even in nonfiction texts. I remember the first time I read Michel Foucault. It was a sense of wonder, although it was a philosophical text. Mm. I said, oof,
yes.
This will keep me busy for years.
Yeah, somebody who leaps to mind as you say that, that's a modern writer for me is Ted Chiang.
Yeah, absolutely.
So many of his stories hit me that way.
I guess we'll meet him here again.
Yes, I hope so.
Okay, J. Park, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
But for today, we have chosen another one as an entry.
That's right.
Shall we start?
It's one that we both quite like. It's Jeff D. is Five by Harlan Ellison.
By Harlan Ellison, yes. The last wild man of science fiction.
He was a wild man. So he passed away fairly recently in 2018. And he wrote a lot of really fantastic stories. This is one of them.
I like his nonfiction as well.
Yes.
His commentary on television, the arts is immaculate.
Absolutely.
Even if you don't like his opinion or if you are angered by something, it's always so inspiring. And you say, you have to work with it. Sometimes you like to work with it. Sometimes you hate to work with it, but you cannot get around when he has said something.
Yeah, he collected a lot of his writing on television in books called The Glass Teat. And I have read at least one of those. I think he's got at least two of them that were published. But you're right. You're exactly right. You know, whether you appreciate his opinion or not, or whether you agree with his opinion or not, you need to appreciate his opinion.
Yeah.
He demands attention and he's usually, right. He's usually correct. When he says something, it's not just to anger people. But he's usually railing against, decisions that are being made not for the art's sake, but for the sake of more viewers possibly, or whatever the perception is of the people that he would call the ones wearing the suits would influence the art is something that he always railed against.
Yeah. I'd like to make a quotation from him here because that expresses it, if you like.
Yes.
It is my lot to wake with anger every morning, to lie down at night even angrier, all in pursuit of one truth that lies at the core of every jot of fiction ever written. We are all in the same skin. But for the time it takes to read these stories, I merely have the mouth. You see before you a child who never grew up, who does not know it's socially unacceptable to ask who farted.
Mm. I love it.
And this anger is very close to my heart. And the rum thing about it is that I got now Harlan Ellison with a rather soft-spoken, rather sensitive, rather caring story like Jeffy's Five, because it was my first contact with Harlan.
Really? This is your first one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I read it when I was 13 years old, I guess. The book was published, the German translation was published in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And that must have been 3 years after he won every decent prize that you could get with the story. He got the Hugo, the Nebula, whatever, and lots of other prizes, and all well deserved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I believe that the first Harlan Ellison I ever read was Repent, Harlequin, Said the TikTok Man.
Yeah.
And I read this story as an adult. I know for sure
an
adult. Yeah, I read it probably 20 years ago, but I was definitely an adult, and the nostalgia in the story just hit me like a wave, which is one of the aspects of the story.
Yeah, talking about that later on.
Yep.
No, I was in the so-called golden age of science fiction. I was really 12 years old when I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And it hit me like an axe as well, because the sense of nostalgia we are going to talk about could be felt even then in 1981 for several reasons, which we might discuss later on.
Okay, yeah. So Jeffy Was Five was first published in 1977 in the July 1977 issue of Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine. We highly recommend if you'd like to read it before you hear us discuss it, please do. And can I say that Harlan Ellison was a tremendous audiobook narrator. I think his reading of Jeffy Is Five is the way to get this story, because it blew me away when I first heard it. What he did with it. Just loved it. Just loved how he read this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
absolutely. It was reading it all over again. I heard it only a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I didn't know that he'd read it as an audiobook, and it completely blew me away again.
Yeah.
Although I knew the story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did too. He's just got a style of reading. He's one of the authors who I think could read anybody's story. And he has read some other people's stories as the audiobook narrator, but he's somebody who, just is a tremendous narrator. He's got his own style, and it's a terrific style.
Okay. So, shall we jump into the spoiler pot already?
Let's do.
What do you make of the ending? What do you make of just Jeffy's death?
I think that so Jeffy being this embodiment almost of this nostalgic body embodiment of what I think that the narrator of the story feels is so important and gives his life meaning, being destroyed by the modern world is what I think I felt there. Almost a despair at the modern world and its killing, in a way, of things that I feel that are extremely important.
Yeah.
Did you have a similar feeling?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the fun thing is, the story was published more than 40 years ago. And as everybody can hear, I'm German. It was published in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So the sense of loss is to be seen in layers. You know, when the story was published in 1977, 1978, everybody, I think, of Harlan's age could relate to that. They knew Captain Midnight, more or less.
Yeah, right.
They knew old-time radio.
Mm-hmm.
They knew all the shows that were mentioned that really existed.
Yeah.
And these shows were lost at that time when the story was published, and they were inaccessible. They were only to be remembered. There were no old-time radio collectors with any oomph to put the stuff online again.
Yeah.
So lots of the stuff that is related.
Right, there was no online to put it on, right?
There was no online to put it on.
Mm-hmm.
There was stuff like Quiet Please, for example. All those shows, or a lot of those shows, can be heard today.
Yeah, they sure can.
So the nostalgia has moved, say, I'd say, a bit farther than that. Let me take the, if we take the nostalgia from 1977-78, which is a different set of nostalgia than we have today, I'd say that Harlan is not only, if we take the narrator and Harlan as one person, which for the sake of argument we might do here, he's taking apart his own modernity and his own role in modernity. Mind you, he's a seller for TVs.
Yeah.
He has a TV shop.
That's right.
So he contributes to the destruction of the old nostalgic radio elements.
He does, yeah.
Video kills the radio star, as we said in Europe.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, I don't come from that world, right? I'm nostalgic probably for the 1980s is when I was young. And yet really? The story worked for me. Right, the 1980s, I would have been 12 in 1980.
So same here. But I was never nostalgic for the 80s.
Okay, I am. Yeah, I had a very good childhood. The science fiction I was introduced was the science fiction published in the 80s.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so everything, yeah, rated, you know, what, like you said, the golden age is 12, right? The golden age of science fiction is 12. That's when I started to read things. So
I stopped reading science fiction after Neuromancer. I said they're writing songs of love, but not for me. Mm-hmm. I was always interested in elder science fiction and then came back in the 90s. But I had a hiatus of science fiction from, I guess, 85 to 91, 92.
Yeah, so I read science fiction extensively in the 80s during that time. I was always interested in things like Star Trek, and I got into older science fiction. I remember reading things like Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke, some Robert A. Heinlein, but mostly Isaac Asimov Foundation series, which was being released again in the 80s. That's when he did Foundation's Edge and all that. So it sent me back in time to the 50s to read Foundation. And then, like you, I fell in love with a lot of the older stuff. But that's sort of that. So, but I didn't ever have old time radio, like you were saying. So I guess my point in bringing that all up is that it still worked for me, even though I wasn't nostalgic for exactly what he was talking about. I was nostalgic, and why be nostalgic? It's because you have, or I had, maybe an idealistic or a very good memories of being that age, and now being, you know, in my 50s and, you know, having to go to work every day and being a little tired of that maybe makes you wonder, you know, well, what is it that's good about this, you know? And so it could be that the modern world for me means growing up. Right. So you grow up, you have responsibilities, you sort of have to fight for the time to do this conversation, for example, where, you know, these are things that I find extremely valuable and worthwhile. You know, I spend time doing it because I love it and I find it worth doing, when a lot of what I do at work doesn't seem worth doing. And, you know, so my Jeffy dies a little bit, you know, when I can't do the things that I find are so important.
That's one of the aspects. Another aspect, I think, have you ever time to deal with, say, collectors or antiquarians?
Have I? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine is a collector of old 78ers. He must have 15,000 or 18,000 78ers.
Wow.
And his music, and his musical taste really ends more or less with the end of the 78ers.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And whenever I visited him, we lived together in one town when I was a student, and I came out of his house and I had to step into the modern world again.
Oh.
Because his immersion into this old music, and he had old record players and gramophones and stuff like that, there was always a kind of immersion that made me go back in time for the moment or for the time I was there. And I was reminded of the Jeffy idea, which is the same feeling brought to the top. You know, yes, Jeffy Ken band time, Jeffy Ken immerse himself into his own time bubble and can take other people into his bubble, which leads to his death inevitably in the end.
Yeah.
But the idea that people who are connected to these old things can turn their surroundings into a state of being nostalgic and put into the time at the same time is an immense power.
Yes.
Which Harlan has here exaggerated a little for the sake of the story, but which is not something he has pulled out of the hat.
Right. You're right. It is an immense power. I think the only thing I can point to that I've had a similar experience with a collector is Star Trek. I guess an extreme vision of that would be down in Las Vegas. They used to have a Star Trek permanent exhibit where you would go down there to Las Vegas, and in the Las Vegas Hilton, you'd go in there, and part of that hotel was Star Trek World. And you would go in there and you would live there for an hour or two, and then you'd come out and just not really want to leave there. But you're right. It is extremely strong.
Yeah. And there's a complimentary film to the story by Harlan. It's Woody Allen's Radio Days. I don't know. Have you seen it?
I have not. I'm writing it down.
You
Radio
should.
Days.
Okay. Radios. Mm-hmm. It's a story of a young boy who is more or less like Woody Allen, growing up in a Jewish family in New York. And he's remembering his addiction to radio in that time. And Woody Allen quotes from serials that have not existed, but which are very, very closely related to the serials that Harlan mentions here. And I think it's interesting that between Harlan's story and Woody Allen's movie, it's 86 or 87. There are only 10 years. So we might think, why does the nostalgia for this area comes up in this decade?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's a good question.
There's always some modernism hanging around science fiction and around the culture of the 60s. And there's a teleological sense of the world development. Things are getting better and better and better and better. And then they didn't in the 80s, most obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And then nostalgia
and then
starts
70s,
to come up.
So I know that one of the things, now I'm thinking about the life of Harlan Ellison. I know that around this time, I can't remember the exact year, but he was the editor for Dangerous Visions.
And, oh, I see.
And Dangerous Visions came about because authors were getting rejected for very good stories. And so Dangerous Visions was a push against the establishment that were only wanting a certain type of story. So Harlan Ellison said, okay, give me the stories that no one will publish. Give me your best story, not worrying about whether it can be published or not, right? And all these authors submitted to Dangerous Visions these stories and published it, and it changed the world. It might have spawned the new age movement or the new wave, the new wave movement.
Yeah.
It was definitely of that. Mm-hmm.
There was some trouble about the third volume that never came
out,
right?
That's right. The third volume never did come out.
I remember Chris Priest has written about it rather fumingly.
Yeah, exactly.
The book that never existed or something like that.
The book that never was published. But he did Dangerous Visions, Dangerous Visions 2. But that could feed into this because if he's pushing against a world that he feels is more and more against him, he's fighting against studio executives. He's fighting against people that want to publish his story and not pay him. He's pushing against the type of story that he wants to publish that people don't want because it doesn't fit anywhere. And that's a group feeling, amongst a lot of authors. And thus this story. So why be nostalgic for the past? Well, science fiction was new. It was being created, but maybe it was before the gatekeepers existed, those kinds of things. So it is interesting something that you said that stuck in my head that I have not ever thought about is why in this time are people feeling nostalgic for the past? So I do feel nostalgic for the 80s, like you said, but I had a very comfortable life in the 80s.
But in the 80s it starts. Have you ever heard of Steely Dan?
Yeah.
The band?
Yes, I have.
And there was a record by Donald Fagen, I think 1982, The Nightfly.
Hmm.
where he lives out his nostalgia for the 50s and 60s.
Interesting.
And I think the nostalgic moment really happens in that time. And yeah. I think Harlan was a little bit ahead of the curve, as he every so often was, with this rather nostalgic reenacting of the radio. And there were two things that that touched me really. Next time we might talk about Stanley G. Weinbaum.
Uh-huh, right.
And you might remember the mention of Weinbaum here in this story.
Yes, that's right. He did. Yes.
Yeah. Talking about stories by Robert E. Howard, who committed suicide.
Uh-huh.
Talking about stories by Stanley G. Weinbaum, who died of throat cancer, if I remember correctly, in the age of 34, 35. Mm-hmm. People who were not able to fulfill the promise they made to the world.
Fascinating.
Or they were given to the world. And he, or Jeffy, is able to have in his time bubble stories never written by those people. Mm. And this tears the strings of my heart.
Yes.
Because when I got to know Stanley G. Weinbaum, I thought, wow, what might he have written if he had had the time?
Oh, no kidding, yeah. I mean, there's so many people that we can say that of.
Yeah. Oh, one of the last Conan stories, Beyond the Black River, is one of the most impressive pieces Howard has ever written. And what we have written when he was 40, 45, you know?
Yeah, right.
And I found it especially touching that Harlan mentions these authors especially, saying, I hear a new piece by him, I hear a new piece by him, Jeffy is able to give me the new stories by these persons. Yes. And this is a different kind of nostalgia than just saying, oh, I want those old stories over and over and over again. I want to hear the Quiet Please show from 13th December 1942. Which is a static nostalgia, and with your dynamic nostalgia, which is something entirely different.
It is, yes, you're right. You're right, that's fascinating to think about. But yeah, and he also mentioned movies like, you know, I think
the
it was
Bogart
the Demolished Man or something with...
No, it's with Demolished Man, yeah, right, mm-hmm, with Bogart right. And...
Yeah, I can't remember who else, but you're right. That is an excellent point, because right, Bogart passed away too. He died of cancer. In the 50s, I think 57.
We went to the movies, and while everyone else was seeing a comedy starring Goldie Hawn and Ryan O'Neill, Jeffy and I were enjoying Humphrey Bogart as a professional thief Parker in John Huston's brilliant adaptation of the Donald Westlake novel Slayground. And I know that so Harlan loved Donald Westlake.
That's right, that's right.
Yeah. And he's able to put a lot of honorifics or what is called homages in the story just to recall the old heroes and giving them a new life, which is something, it is nostalgia, yes, absolutely, but it's a nostalgia for things that have not been, not nostalgia for things that have been.
That's so true. Yeah, so he said, so what's playing today? And the answer is Bullwhip Justice and The Demolished Man. And he says, Bester's The Demolished Man? Oh, that's super. And then who's in it? Franco Tone, Evelyn Keyes, Lionel Barrymore, and Elisha Cook Jr.
This is
a whole aspect of this that, I hadn't thought about. Right, he was bringing people back to life. He was he was seeing the full potential of people whose lives have been cut short.
You know that I hang around in the hauntology scene, right?
The what scene?
Hauntology.
Hauntology?
My English friends, the music guys.
Uh-huh.
With the old stuff.
Yes, yes.
And the electronic music made from library music or old ideas from the 70s and 80s, TV shows, etc. That's where I hang around as DJ Space Serpent.
Very nice.
And there is a philosophical and political background to it, the works of Mark Fisher, who unluckily committed suicide also in 2017, and he said that the hauntology scene and the music has grown out of a feeling of a slow cancellation of the future.
Mm.
That futures did not happen that were expected, and this creates a sense of nostalgia as well. And I think, again, Harlan was ahead of the curve here with the story.
That is such a good point.
It would be diminishing the story if you say it's just someone who wants to hear the old radio stories again. That's not the point.
Yes.
He wants the culture of this story, and he wants the, what's it called? Ah, here we go. What Harlan shows us is that the achievement of the time he's not nostalgic for. All the achievements that are lost in the transition to modernity are something worthwhile to remember. Mm-hmm. I think the second paragraph, although it's consumerism, if you like, the second paragraph shows it already. One moment, please. Mm-hmm. When I was 5, a Clark bar was as fat around as a gripping end of a Louisville Slugger and pretty nearly 6 inches long. And they used real chocolate to coat it. And it crunched very nicely when you bit into the center. And the paper it came wrapped in smelled fresh and good when you peeled off one end to hold the bar so it wouldn't melt onto your fingers. Today, a Clark bar is as thin as a credit card. They use something artificial and awful tasting instead of pure chocolate. The thing is soft and soggy. It costs 15 or 20 cents instead of a decent, correct nickel. And they wrap it so you think it's the same size it was 20 years ago. Only it isn't. It's slim and ugly and nasty tasting and not worth a penny, much less 15 or 20 cents.
Hmm.
So what he describes here is not what sometimes Americans call the suck fairy, that something you really liked turns out to be something nasty when you're grown up.
Yeah.
Which happens as well.
Right.
Every now and again.
Yep.
But he says that there is a decline in stuff that is sold to us as the same thing but isn't anymore. And I could name numerous sweets that are sold in Germany that had undergone this process.
Mm.
And still undergo this process.
Yeah, numerous things.
Changing of the recipes, etc.
Right.
And I think he's ranting against that. I don't think he's ranting against the passing of time. It does.
Right. It's a ranting against sort of corporations, right? The decision making for profit.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but I'd go farther. I'd go farther than corporations. Corporations are reacting to people. It's not always, the bad corporation that is. I think that's a little too easy.
Okay.
What he rants against is the, I think, if I interpret him correctly, that we forget that the modernity has a price in itself, and it's a tough price to pay.
Hmm.
And Jeffrey is always dying for not wanting or not being able to pay the price. If I think of the ambivalence of the end of the story, wait a minute. It's a good world, all things considered. It's much better than it used to be in a lot of ways. People don't die from the old diseases anymore. They die from new ones, but that's progress, isn't it? Isn't it? Tell me. Somebody please tell me.
Hmm.
And what I really, really, being 52, really estimate is that he lets us as readers in this ambivalence. Also in judging the character of Jeffrey's parents, and it's quite clear, although not absolutely clear how it's done, that the mother is killing Jeffrey.
Mm.
Or it's letting him die, at
least.
Yes, yes. Probably killing him.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interview by Harlan about the ending of Jeffrey, which strongly contradicts, for example, the Wikipedia entry.
Mm.
Which makes it all the harder to really make head or tails of what happens.
Yeah. Well, I believe Harlan Ellison. What did he have to say?
It's in the biography by Ned Segalov.
Uh-huh. Yeah, which I read.
There's, mm-hmm. there's an interview in the end, at the end.
Yeah.
In the appendices. Here we go. I quote from Harlan. There's something heartbreaking about impaired children, and in some ways Jeffrey is impaired. He's gloriously impaired, and he comes to a bad end. But very few people understand that the mother has set it up so that the kid will die. It's a mercy killing, but it's an inadvertent mercy killing. That's why when people read the story, they don't get the ending. They don't get the ending about things like the lights in the house dimming as the radio falls into the bathtub, because these days lights don't dim. And
I knew what that was, and maybe it's because I'm old. I don't know.
Yeah. And the thing is, for example, in Wikipedia, you can read Jeffrey's mother drowns him in the bathtub.
Hmm.
But even Harlan's interpretation does not fit 100% the story, because as it happens, the narrator hears, when the mother comes from above, rock music from the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So she cannot put it into the bathtub.
Hmm.
But Jeffrey must be already dead because you're hearing rock music. Or Jeffrey is dying so that he cannot immerse his field bubble anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And is set out to rock music.
Yes.
Which never played in the house, as you might recall.
Right.
Modern radio stations were not to be received into Jeffy's house.
That's right.
So yeah. At the moment when you can listen to rock music, something must have happened to Jeffy, and I thought he was dead already. But then it's right. Then the light starts to dim. And mm-hmm. in so far, the not quite point of death, as the coroners would say, makes the story more and more ambivalent.
Yes,
and I love Harlan for that. It never, you never stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
If you, it's a story, you never really finished. Same with I have no mouth and I must scream.
Mm, yep.
The story stops, but it's not finished.
Right.
And that's wonderful. It's a wonderful way of writing short stories.
Right. And that is something that he does over and over.
Yeah.
Just extremely talented. Beautiful.
So, nostalgia mm-hmm. at a certain point. Maybe I'm arguing in circles now, but why was the story received so vivatically? If you are so full of enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
I really have trouble to understand that at the time, because at least Harlan, I would have understood if the story had been 10 years later, say mid-80s, late-80s, end of the Cold War, short before the fall of the Berlin Wall, when Woody Allen's film was made and published. I would have understood it at that time. Why 77?
I don't know. I hadn't really thought of that. Why a typical fan would enjoy this story. Simply because of what you're saying, they would love another Stanley Weinbaum story. They would love a new Edgar Rice Burroughs series in Jupiter. They would like more Robert E. Howard, you know? So you do have that aspect of it.
But a lot of science fiction fans that were, say, voting for the Hugo at the time were born 52, 57.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're a tad too young to be that nostalgic, aren't they?
Yeah. Possibly.
And it's, if you read about the prizes, it's all over the board that people say this is a great story. And mm-hmm. there are plot holes that you can drive a lorry through.
Yeah.
To be
for
honest.
Sure. What about, Joe Haldeman wrote a story called The Hemingway Hoax. That was also an award winner. It was also an award winner, but what was going on there is he, there was an alternate world or an alternate universe that he could go get novels written by like Ernest Hemingway, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, so his life was never cut short in the same way as this. And that was also a very popular story, you know, just the idea that in another universe, somebody's writing more stuff. And, you know, so that idea alone, I think, is appealing to people.
Yeah.
That would be a timeless appeal. But this story here, Jeff DS5, is much deeper than that. There's, like you said, there's much going on that I hadn't even thought about before you brought them up. So it's a deeper story for me already because of our conversation.
Yeah, the story has been a companion since I read it first.
Uh-huh,
and, you know, I worked for 5 years in an antiquarian bookstore and I have lots of old music here. And I have a sense of nostalgia for some stuff from the 70s and sometimes even for stuff from the 90s. But it always struck a certain chord with me.
Yeah.
Because the sense of loss with all the achievements of modernity is something we may not forget, I think.
And possibly, like you said, a disillusionment with modernity because, you know, just like you read at the end, is this modern life better? You know, are we actually driving somewhere that's better or was it better then? And I think in our world right now, we're increasingly feeling that it was better then, whatever someone's then was. But there is this disillusionment, you know, something for me, something tangible, something material is the whole space program here in the United States, how, we really hadn't done anything since Apollo. you know, since going to the moon. And, you know, at that time, you know, I was born right around then. So I grew up in a time where everybody was saying, hey, yeah, we're going to be in Mars. You know, 2001 was far away and it was going to be full of space travel and all this amazing stuff. Well, one of the things that's occurred during this year, during this stunning year, is again, you know, it's sort of the United States' return in space travel. And again, there's some promise there that something's going to be moving forward. And that is only one of the things that we were promised. And I put promise in quotes.
Where's my jetpack?
Where's my jetpack? Right. What the future was going to be and what the future is now that we're in it. And what our children of today are looking forward to, I don't get a sense of a lot of happiness looking forward. I don't get that sense.
No, that's a slight lack of optimism.
Right, and I think that that's some stuff, you know, if you think about Repent, Harlequin Said the TikTok Man, is, you know, in a way, I know that there's a lot more to it than this, but in a way, a rebellion against the schedule, right? This tight schedule, this need that we have to be productive, this go, go, go that we all have that sucks the life out of us. You know, it's a railing against that. And that is also a modern thing. Not that it didn't exist in the past, you know.
No, it did. I'm hesitating to recommend it to you. This is a family program, isn't it? But you should read the first paragraphs or pages at least of the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels.
Okay.
It's been predicted there, the acceleration.
Really? Okay.
Really, yeah. It's a fulminating, very, very interesting text because the sense of loss, the sense of destruction in the sense of being more and more and more productive, the rat race, if you like, has been diagnosed and at that time, in the 19th century, mind you, and it said, this is not going to get better. And the sense of acceleration has been, and in so far we may be looking like two old men whining about the past, the sense of acceleration is much older, and one could even be nostalgic to that sense of acceleration, if you get my drift.
Yes, I do.
I'm not a Ludite.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And in so far, I know that going to the dentist, for example, is much, much better than 30 years ago, even.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm not angry about progress. But you have to admit that there are prices you have to pay. And if you don't think you pay the price, you're out of your mind. And I do think what Harlan maybe has not reflected about, couldn't at that time, that to surround yourself with artifacts of that time doesn't heal the wound. It can be fun to, for example, listen to an audio drama. It can be fun to read an old story. But what we really want to have is a new story by Stanley G. Weinbaum. And we're not bound to get it anytime soon.
Yeah.
And, for example, some people say, what would have happened if the Beatles had lived through the 80s? Would they have made, or through the 70s even, would they have made even greater records? Maybe, but the answer to that is the Rolling Stones, who haven't produced a decent record for 30 or 35 years. Maybe sometimes it's good that things come to an end.
Right, right.
Then again, what would Jimi Hendrix do as a blues grandfather?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm remembering Jerry Seinfeld, who stopped his show and when asked, you know, why are you stopping now? You know, things are going great. And he said, well, you know, look at the Beatles.
Right. Yeah.
He's saying we need to have an end to this thing. And why not now?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think, as pity as I think about it, maybe it's right. And even this is in the ambivalence of this really, really short story. And I think the more often I read a story normally every 5 years or so. And it's getting deeper and deeper and deeper, which is a rare feat.
That's interesting, because now you're making me think even more generally, you know, at mortality itself. You know, this is how we live. We have an end. You know, every one of us has that end.
And the culture has an end as well. And certain parts of culture or strains of culture have an end. And, you know, I still listen to radio. Radio still, the old media is not completely vanishing. If you have vinyl records still, although you had CDs and downloads, you have still books, although you have television.
Yeah.
The old media is not replacing, the new media is not replacing the old media, but it's changing them. You have lots of books written like movies, for example.
Yeah.
Which doesn't do them all too good.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. They're not taking advantage of what they can do. Right.
Yeah. If the old media starts to imitate the new media, normally some rather sad hybrid comes around.
Yeah. Right. Fascinating.
Okay.
And heartbreaking, right?
And heartbreaking as well.
Heartbreaking story. Yeah.
Yeah. And you should add it with Woody Allen's Radio Days. You will see it fits like a glove.
Okay.
And it's a wonderful movie in itself.
Nice.
It might be, of all the Woody Allen movies, maybe my favorite.
Okay, great. I've written it down. Definitely going to watch it.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. So
thank you. Thank you. This was our rant and rave for today. Please tune in next time. We'll have more command of the facts then.
Okay. That's right.
Next one on Stanley G. Weinbaum, Martian Odyssey.
That's right.
You're right with that?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yep, a Martian Odyssey. Looking forward to that very much.
Okay.
Well, thank you for listening, everyone. And we'll see you soon.
See you. Bye.